to check in with everyone about the handbooks to see how they were going. I know that there are some groups that have decided to do collective handbooks. In discussing that with Aicha this morning, she felt it was, I'm looking for a pen. I'd like to have a pen while I'm,
I have one in my hand this morning. I think I must have, I have a pen, I can just borrow it.
Okay, don't let me walk off with it. There you go. She said that it was going extremely well, she felt, in terms of as a group project. So I just wanted to spend a few minutes just hearing from everyone whether, you know, how many people, are most people doing this in the end as a collective project connected with their mentoring group or some other? And if not, how's it going? Does it seem to be working? Any thoughts? Yeah?
Yeah, we're doing it collectively and dividing it between the main divisions in the course.
Uh-huh.
Each taking a section. We're going to go over each other's sections as well. So,
Is everybody doing it that way? Is that how it's sort of evolved?
Oh, yeah. We're not doing it ours as a group.
Uh-huh.
We're doing ours individually.
I mean, I'm attracted to, you know, in terms of thinking about how this is as an experiment, the idea of it being a group project seems to me a good one in principle. It means that people can focus more on particular sections of it, and the end product will have a more comprehensive character. But since, of course, the co-mentoring groups are more or less randomly assigned, it doesn't necessarily mean that each group would have the same dispositions in that respect, but there won't be any demerits, as it were, for not doing it collectively. But I won't take that into consideration as a plus or a minus. So I won't expect people who are doing it individually to produce an encyclopedia of the form that will be more like what comes out of a group project, just because of the amount of time people would have to devote to it. But if there's a group where you're not doing it that way, you might discuss it and see if, in the end, that might be a constructive way of producing the work. Is everyone sort of on track for the first paper, which I guess is due 10 days or so from, I forget exactly what the due date is.
A week from Monday.
What?
I think a week from Monday.
A week from Monday, yeah. It's due the Monday after the end of the day. Everybody feel they've got a topic and some initial ideas as to what they're doing? More or less? I'm sure this will be an enhancement to your Halloween weekend. All right.
Can you maybe just go over some of the ideas of? So you're looking more for a dedicated paper on a specific reading or a specific two readings.
Yes.
Yeah, more an engagement in the material that you presented in the course.
Right. Rather than a general paper, short paper on an idea that we've been discussing, kind of unhinged from the particular material in the class. Now, I'm generally extremely flexible about these things. Sometimes people write papers that are not directly engaging a core reading, and I feel it's okay. But my experience over the years teaching this class is that papers that really focus in on a particular reading characterize the argument and then raise some kind of issue that they want to be in dialogue with, they tend to be better because they have more focus, the points are clearer. Certainly, it's often easier for me then to give feedback on the paper. You'll have a chance to rewrite it if you write something that's completely off base and doesn't work, so I wouldn't fret too much if you're trying to do something else. I want to avoid these papers being too ambitious. These are not meant to be short-term papers. I don't expect people to bring lots of ancillary material. Now, some of you are very sophisticated. You've been through a lot of these ideas in many different ways. In that case, it's totally appropriate to bring other material to bear on some piece. There was somebody was right, yeah.
Well, I guess I was just going to ask a question, I guess, about my topic. I was going to do something related to a general idea, but then take that general idea and say, like, in light of these arguments that were made, this data that was done on this particular related topic, we can deduce that something related to this general topic. I mean, is that something?
Well, it's a very abstract statement.
I mean, because you said that, you're saying it's just abstract.
Yeah.
You're saying that a general idea should probably avoid general ideas.
Well, what I mean is for somebody to invoke the idea of class without talking about any of the readings we've done.
Oh, okay. I was just asking, versus like specifically engaging the author of a particular paper on that subject, because I'm having some difficulties myself with not so much of a background, taking a look at an article and going, yeah, these are the problems with it that haven't been already addressed in other papers that sort of refute these arguments or whatever, or maybe they don't quite refute them, but maybe there's not enough data to support one or the other. So I'm sort of left with, how do I engage something that I don't really have that much of a background in, and that arguments have already been given by, let's say, you, for example. They're so well thought out. The same ideas that I had, only way better thought out. You know what I'm saying?
Given that I didn't directly discuss every reading that was in the core readings, there should be plenty of items in which you could have your own thoughts about. I mean, I do recognize the problem, and I don't expect you to come up with novel, brilliant new twists and insights and things. I want just clear-headed thinking about some problem connected to the core readings. But you could try, or you could come and talk to me, more detail about what you're actually thinking of doing, and we can see if I think it's a good idea or not.
Yeah, no, I know. It's just the six to eight pages of pure material is a lot of material. So you'd have to come up with a lot of new ideas in order to fill these pages.
First of all, no reason to feel awkward about raising this issue. I'm sure there are other people who are feeling the same problem. The problem, when you get to be an old hand at this, and some of the grad students are old hands and some are new hands at it, but the problem is always, how can I possibly get into 6 to 8 pages all the things I want to say? There's never a problem filling 6 to 8 pages on any topic whatsoever. There's never a problem of having too little to say about it. And that's not just because people are wordy. It's because of recognizing what it means to say something carefully and systematically. So partially, I think that's just a question of experience. When you actually get down to start writing this, most of the undergraduates who are taking this course don't usually find that they don't have enough to say. When you actually start working on a problem. But we can talk specifically about that. Yeah. Should be fun, though. Yeah. Writing paper should be a highlight of a course, not the dread and nightmare of a course.
If you say so.
And if you're a graduate student and writing papers is the nightmare of a course, then you're in the wrong business.
Yeah.
Because your whole career is going to be a nightmare. So. All right. Solidarity and rationality. Solidarity is, of course, one of the core ideas of social movements, of radical change, of revolutionary challenge, the notion of solidarity is absolutely foundational to the possibility of challenging systems of oppression and domination. It's hard to imagine strategy that could be plausible in the absence of solidarity as a social resource available to challengers. And it is, I think, probably the central concept around class formation and class struggle, that is understanding how class formations build on solidarity in order to make class struggles possible. So I think it's an appropriate idea to give prominence to. It also turns out to be a concept that fits very nicely in with the micro-foundational models that I was talking about last time, with strategic action theory, or game theory as it's commonly called, as a way of understanding the micro-foundations of collective action. Solidarity is very closely tied up with rationality and the question of the nature of the choices people make. And that's what I want to lay out today, is the logic of solidarity, how to think about this with respect to these kinds of models. So first, a definition. Class solidarity refers to the willingness of individual members of a class to support the collective struggles of the class by bearing various kinds of individual costs or sacrifices. So solidarity means, to be solidaristic means to be willing to bear costs for collective struggle. Now, you can feel solidarity without bearing costs. You know, people feel solidarity with the struggles of people around the world. I'm not referring to to solidarity merely as a sentiment, although that's not unimportant, for the willingness to bear costs. Solidarity, though, as a theoretical concept with respect to class formation, I think the central idea is this notion of willingness of individuals to bear costs for collective struggles. This would include things like active participation in strikes, but it also would include more passive support, not crossing a picket line. Some not crossing a picket line could be a very small sacrifice, it just means an inconvenience, but nevertheless what it reflects is a willingness to bear some kind of cost personally in order to advance a collective purpose. The capacity of workers to struggle against capitalists, in the particular case of class formation, but more generally the capacity of oppressed groups to struggle against oppression, hinges on that kind of willingness to make sacrifices. Klaus Offa, in the paper that will be read for Monday, makes this nice contrast between two important kinds of, or two different ways that people participate in collective action. One is based on their willingness to act, and the other on their willingness to pay. And he draws the distinction between the key condition for working class and capitalist class solidarity. This, capitalists also have a solidarity problem, how to form collective actions to defend their positions. That the problem that capitalists face centers around the willingness to pay. What gets recruited in capitalist collective action is money for purposes of struggle. Whereas for workers, what gets recruited is a willingness to act. And the willingness to act is a much more demanding kind of problem to solve. The kinds of sacrifices that are most needed for collective action among oppressed groups are the kinds of sacrifices that come from acting, not just from monetary contribution. So how should we think about this issue? How should we think about solidarity? Jan Elster proposes that the concept of solidarity can be understood best if we think of it in relationship to the free rider problem of collective action. and it's the way in which solidarity provides a kind of solution to the free rider problem that gives it its particular power within social movements. So first, what I need to do is to remind you of the formal structure of the free rider problem. As I said last time, I'm assuming that this is reasonably familiar to people. To fully explicate the logic of a free rider problem would take us quite a bit of time, and I hope it's unnecessary. It's explained in the readings and in the notes. But still, I want to just remind people of it. The free rider problem gets its formal treatment in the analysis of what's called the prisoner dilemma game. It's basically a situation in which each person in some kind of collective situation has two choices. The choice of either to cooperate with everyone else, which bears some cost, so cooperation isn't costless, or to refuse to cooperate. That's referred to as defection from cooperation. If everybody cooperates, you get cooperation, universal cooperation. The free rider situation is one where everyone else cooperates, but you don't. And if there is some benefit from everybody cooperating, victory in a strike, let's say, or the increased probability of your preferred candidate winning an election, or whatever is the gain from cooperation, if you can get the gain from cooperation without bearing the costs, then you're a free rider. You're riding on other people's sacrifices. And what the prisoner's dilemma shows, in a familiar way, I hope, is that if each person in a game that has this character is perfectly self-interested, all they care about is what's best for themselves, and perfectly rational, they're not subject to any illusions. They're just making a choice based on their self-interest. What each individual will do is defect. But the result is universal defection, which is worse for the individual than universal cooperation. Universal cooperation is the preferred outcome, but each person acting individually on pure rationality with perfect information, so there's no errors being made here, produces universal defection. And that's the prisoner's dilemma, that there's no way out. In the prisoner's dilemma, there is no way out. The equilibrium solution is shooting yourself in the foot. There's no way out. Because if you're stubborn and decide, what the hell, since I know universal defection is a bad idea, I'm going to unilaterally cooperate, then you're even worse off. There is one thing worse than universal defection, and that's to be the only cooperator. You know, it's like if in a strike situation, the only cooperator in a wildcat strike is called. If everybody goes out, you win. If nobody goes out, you lose. If you're the only person who goes out, you get fired. Right. So that's called the sucker penalty. The sucker penalty is what happens if you cooperate and everybody else defects. Well, three quantities are defined by Elster in the prisoner's dilemma, collective action, free rider problem. These, in the lecture notes, these are the bottom of page 2. The difference between universal cooperation and universal defection, that difference is called the gains from cooperation. That's the difference that you get as an individual. This is always with respect to individual payoffs. And the reason it's with respect to individual payoffs is that individuals are making the choices in question. Individuals are the ones who decide whether or not to participate. That's the difference between what you get if everyone, including you, cooperates versus everyone abstains. That's the gain from cooperation. The gain from free riding is the difference between what you get if everyone else cooperates and you defect. In many contexts, the gains from free riding are large, and unambiguously large. There are many contexts in which you will be much better off personally in terms of your own material interests if everybody else does the right thing and you don't. And then there is the loss for unilateralism. That is, the loss the individual experiences by being the only person to participate in the struggle if everybody else defects. That's called the sucker penalty also. Now, these stories are told in these simplified forms, what you do versus everyone else. Obviously, there's gradients. It can be what you and a few of your buddies do versus everybody else. That doesn't fundamentally change the character of the story. So there'll be, the sucker penalty will occur if very few people cooperate and most people defect in a strike. In the Wildcat Strike story, if three workers show up with pickets, they all get fired if 1,000 stay in. If 600 show up and 400 stay in, then they're not fired. And somewhere there's some threshold for the sucker penalty, which is probably unknown exactly what the threshold is. So the stories, the actual empirical cases are much more complicated, but I think these basic quantities, this inventory is a useful one. All right. So as we know, the prisoner's dilemma preference ordering gives each person's first choice, the highest thing they want to see happen. Their first preference is everybody else cooperates, I defect. Their second preference is everybody cooperates. And the third preference is everybody defects. Everybody acting on those preference orders yields the outcome that everybody defects, and so that's suboptimal. That's the free rider problem. Now, the question then is, we do observe in the world that there are collective actions, so the free rider problem cannot be the end of the story. If the free rider problem defined the actual choices of people, then we would never see a collective action. The purpose of specifying the free rider problem, as I explained yesterday, is not to suggest that it accurately depicts all of the action situations in which people find themselves, but it provides us a way of asking more precise questions about how actual struggles take place by seeing how they violate the underlying assumptions of that prisoner's dilemma model. First, however, I think it's important to dispense with what could be thought of as a false solution to the problem. A false solution to the free rider problem is to say that the reason we get collective working class struggles is because it's in the collective interests of the group as a whole. Working class struggles occurs and takes the form it does because it is in the collective interest of the working class as such. Sometimes you will see explanations of struggle that have that form. That because it's in the collective interests of the class, that explains the existence of the struggle. This kind of explanation, I think, is unsatisfactory. That is, invoking a collective interest as a solution to the free rider problem and explaining a collective struggle is not a satisfactory solution. Because, first of all, it doesn't answer the question, why do the individuals who actually participate in the struggle do so? You still have, you know, even if there's some sense in which it's the collective interest which is explaining it, you have to explain why then individuals act in the collective interest. And you can't just simply say because they're members of that collective. Since individuals are not robots, they're not merely instruments of the collective, they make choices. You still have to explain why they make choices. So whether or not individuals participate in struggles is something that needs explaining, and invoking collective interest simply is a non-explanation of that phenomenon. Secondly, if collective action is explained by collective interests, then you face the opposite problem that collective action theorists worry about. You have to explain why it happens so rarely. As the collective interests are always there, if they explain collective struggles, then you have the problem of explaining why collective struggles don't occur all the time. The explanation is either too strong or too weak. It's too strong an explanation because it predicts vastly more struggles than occur. It's too weak an explanation because it doesn't actually explain why individuals participate in these struggles that do occur. We therefore have to go back to the micro level, as we need, as part of our explanation, some account of the processes by which individuals make their choices. Elster suggests that we do so in a particular sequence of steps. So this is a methodological prescription. This is not a theoretical argument about the relative importance of different kinds of mechanisms. It's an argument for how to build an explanation for why people participate. He says, first, assume that behavior is both rational and self-interested. That's the starting point. That's what we've done in the prisoner's dilemma. If this does not work, assume rationality. So we keep the rationality assumption, but we relax the self-interested assumption. And only if this is unsuccessful should one assume that the individual participation is irrational. So what Elster suggests, methodologically, is that we first construct a model of perfect rational, self-interested choices. We observe that that doesn't explain the phenomenon we're studying. And then we relax the self-interested part of the explanation. And then we relax the rationality part of the explanation. Now, it could be, as a result of that, we end up always with explanations that include some forms of irrationality and some forms of non-self-interest. There's no presupposition here that relaxing those conditions implies a priori what's most important. Let me give you an analogy to explain why this is what we're talking about. When you go to a doctor with a set of symptoms, the doctor has a diagnostic checklist, right? The diagnostic checklist is a sequence of steps the doctor goes through in order to diagnose what underlying causes might be producing the symptoms. You come in with a headache and a sore throat, and you've had the headache for a week, and the doctor wants to diagnose it. Now the question is, what is the sequence that the doctor prescribes? This is a methodological question. It's not a substantive one about the actual causes of your headache. It's a methodological procedure that the doctor goes through. Well, the doctor is under a number of constraints. One is, there's some tests that are extremely easy, can be done in the doctor's office right away, and can rule out certain possibilities. So in the doctor's case, the first things on the list are the cheapest and easiest. That's why you get your blood pressure taken and you get a thermometer stuck in your mouth. Those are two diagnostic procedures. They help to refine the possible causes of your symptoms cheaply. The things which may, in fact, be most provide the best information may be extremely expensive. And so they may do a bunch of less efficient, less discriminating tests first, because that enables them to rule out a bunch of possibilities, and they may not have to go to the more expensive ones. So there's a methodological logic to that sequencing, which in the doctor's case has some combination of the likelihood. So you use tests that rule out big categories of things first, the likelihood of the underlying, of identifying the right cause, and the cost of doing so. Well, that's all that Elster's prescription, his diagnostic methodology, says. Look, it's really cheap to construct a model of rational self-interest. There's zillions of ways that people can be irrational. You know, there's a vast array of different forms of irrationality. And there's a vast array of forms of motivation other than self-interest. Let's start with interest, self-interest, and rationality, because that's the easiest and cheapest kind of model to give. That's why it's a mistake to assume that because so much attention is given to those models, which actually turn out to be pretty complicated pretty quickly, even though they're cheap relative to the other models. They're still hard. It's a mistake to interpret because all the attention is given to, so much attention is given to those models, that that actually corresponds to a substantive claim that in the world people are always rational and self-interested. I want to just keep emphasizing that because I think a lot of the hostility that sociologists in general and critical theorists in particular have to rational choice theory comes from the mistake that the mistaken view of those kinds of models, that because the models revolve around rationality and self-interest, they imply the world revolves around self-interest. Now, as I said, a lot of game theorists encourage that mistake because they never get beyond those models themselves, and that's because a lot of people who work on those models do so just because they like the models, not because they're actually interested in explaining anything. As Paul Krugman says about neoclassical economics in a recent op-ed piece in the New York Times, that basically economics became a subfield of applied mathematics, and the practitioners in the field mistook beauty and truth. They were interested in the elegance of models, and that's because if you're in that kind of mind and you really are good at that kind of exercise, it's fun to play with these models and to do computer simulations if you're doing that form of these modelings and see the beautiful equations that evolve. The criterion was elegance and beauty, not truth. They weren't mainly concerned with using those models for real explanatory purposes, in which case a lot of the action comes in the complexities that the model doesn't capture in actual explanations. And that's what you're trying to get precision on. Precision in understanding the complexity of determinations rather than obliterating that complexity through the simplicity of the model. All right, so the false solution is simply to invoke collective interest. The correct solution involves somehow figuring out how it comes to pass that actual people participate in collective actions, given that if they were perfectly rational and perfectly self-interested, they would not. And therefore, we use that background model of the free rider as a way of diagnosing actual participation. I want to look at, I'm going to discuss three types of solutions to the free rider problem. The one that will be the most important for purposes of understanding solidarity is the second. But I'll review all three of these just to give you a sense of the spectrum. So the first solution to the collective action problem continues to insist on the pure rationality and self-interestedness of the actors. People are only concerned about their own welfare, and they're purely rational. But it relaxes the game. It changes the game by seeing it as a repeated game, an indefinite sequence of games, rather than a single one-shot game. Remember, in the prisoner's dilemma, the prisoners are in their interrogation rooms and they have one decision to make at one point in time. Do I cooperate with the police or do I defect? And that's the end of the game. And the equilibrium in that game is defection. But let's imagine that the game is played over and over again, and that the participants have knowledge about what people did in the previous rounds. That then introduces a new kind of range of strategies. It becomes a much more interesting game. And the strategies are that you can retaliate for what people did in previous rounds. You can punish them for things they did in the past. And because people know that in the future they can be punished for what they do now, they may act differently now in anticipation of the possibility of being punished or not in the future. So this is called an iterated prisoner's dilemma. It's a prisoner's dilemma that gets played over and over and over. It's as if the prisoners are in those rooms and they can either cooperate or defect, but if they defect, they know the other prisoner is going to know that, and so that the next time they're in the room being asked to cooperate, in defect. You know, next time they get caught for robbery, the other person might behave differently. Or they might get kneecapped by the mafia when they get out of prison, so to speak. Now, retaliation becomes possible. So then what you have is you have a temporal strategies in which what you do now is designed to affect what other people will do in the future. An example of this kind of meta strategy is tit for tat. Tit for tat is a simple strategy in a game where if somebody hurts you, you hurt them back. Right? Tit for tat. You retaliate for any harm that's done to you. So if you're cooperating with them and they defect, the next time you defect. That's tit for tat. If the game is repeatedly played, players who employ cooperative strategies at least some of the time generally do better than those who don't. There's a fantastic book which I really recommend. It's a very enjoyable read. It has lots of interesting historical and empirical examples which are very telling. It's called The Evolution of Cooperation by Robert Axelrod. It's published in 1984. Robert Axelrod is a game theorist. He was at Michigan, I believe, at the time he wrote the book. What he did was the following. He organized a computer tournament among game theorists. So he recruited 100 mathematical game theorists who were all hotshots, including Anatole Rapoport, who was one of the granddaddies of game theory. So we had these fans from MIT, Caltech, Harvard, all these fancy game theorists. And he said, okay, we're playing an iterated prisoner's dilemma. You play many rounds. Here are the payoffs. Here are the payoffs if everybody cooperates. If you and your opponent, you're playing one other person. If you both defect, if you defect and they cooperate. So these are the payoffs.
Were they real payoffs?
No, it's just a mathematical game. There are no stakes in it other than winning. You got your name published. And you were supposed to develop a strategy that would be played over an indefinite number of games. There's no defined endpoint. The game would end at some point, but you don't know when it's going to end. And let's see which strategy wins. Gets the highest average payoff against all the other strategies. So each person submits a computer program which says what rule they're going to follow. So here's a simple rule. I am going to cooperate in every game no matter what. No matter what my opponent does, I'm going to cooperate. I'm going to be a universal cooperator. You're a Quaker. So you just do the right thing. Another is the self-interested bastard strategy. I'm going to defect the entire way. I'm just going to... So whenever somebody else cooperates, I'm going to get a higher payoff from them than they will. Another strategy is tit for tat. I'm going to start cooperating. Every time somebody defects, I'm going to defect the next round and then start cooperating again. So tit for tat gives a punishment but forgiveness. It's a mild punishment, but then it tries again to cooperate. That's tit for tat. If I'm harmed, I'm going to harm you back exactly in proportion to how you harm me, then I'm going to start cooperating again in subsequent rounds. Then there's two tits for one tat, as it were. That's the way he described it. I didn't invent it. That's where you defect twice. If somebody defects, then you're going to defect in the next two rounds. That is, you're going to create more harm than you received, and then you'll start cooperating. And other people have super complicated. So there are 100 players. They all submitted the programs. Anatole Rapoport, the granddaddy of all of game theory, he submitted tit for tat, the simplest of all strategies. And it won. He was the only person who submitted tit for tat. And it won. That is, there were particular strategies that did better than it. But those strategies did much worse than other strategies. On average, tit for tat got the highest score, the highest payoff over the life of the game in this tournament. So then Axelrod sent out the results, the full results, of how Tit for Tat did against every other strategy to all 100 players and said, okay, design a new strategy in light of these results. Rapoport again submitted Tit for Tat. All the other fancy game theorists, knowing that Tit for Tat beat them the last time, devised new complicated programs to beat Tit for Tat, to correct the flaws in their program in the previous round. But Tit for Tat won the second round as well. And the reason is that all the efforts to correct the game against Tit for Tat meant that since they're all playing each other, all 100 are playing everyone else, and you win if you have the highest average score, they were killing each other off as well. So this is a nice story. Tit for Tat turns out to be a very powerful game, meta strategy in these games. It's a strategy which you can understand could evolve through trial and error. In culture, it's a reason why we have that as an idea. Every culture apparently has as part of its cultural menu the simple notion that it's an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. That an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth is a biblically sanctioned tit for tat rule. In the First World War, in the trench warfare, tit for tat became the rule of engagement in the stationary fronts, where soldiers would only fire back at the other side if they were fired upon. Nobody wanted to initiate combat. And it was resulting in, there was this pattern of casualties declining rapidly after new recruits got to the front because they learned tit for tat. It was one of the reasons why the general command kept rotating people out of the front and putting new soldiers in, because new soldiers didn't know the rules of the game, and so they would increase the rate of killing of the opponents, but of course that would increase the rate of killing of themselves. Axelrod has a very good discussion of World War I trench warfare in the book that's totally fascinating. And it's all based on tit for tat and the efforts by the military command to disrupt tit for tat. They wanted a much harsher form. They didn't want soldiers cooperating with soldiers on the opposite side of the trench. So that's called an iterated prisoner's dilemma. As these kinds of meta strategies, yeah.
In the game that Axelrod constructed, are you saying that there were other strategies that more complex than tit for tat, if only one game theorist had submitted the more complicated strategy, then that strategy would have won.
It would have beat tit. There were other strategies by themselves that would beat tit for tat, but they would do much, much worse against certain other strategies that might beat tit for tat. Okay. So in a world of multiple strategies all competing with each other, tit for tat on average does better. And therefore, over time, everybody would have ended up with tit for tat, because all other strategies would be highly vulnerable to some other counter-strategy. Tit for tat has the right balance between punishment and forgiveness, is the way Axelrod describes it.
Okay. If I remember well, in the first game, no one submitted the tit for tat, but they would have won. Someone would have submitted that one.
In the first game?
In the first game.
Oh, I didn't know that.
That's what he says.
Okay. Yeah. So in the very, I don't remember that bit. So in the very first game, if somebody had done one tit for two tats or two tats, whatever.
Tit for two tats. Even nicer strategy.
Oh, I see. So even that you only retaliate if you get punished, if you experience two defections. Okay, that's interesting. But that would not have won the second round. It's a terrific. It's an easy book to read. You don't have to know much game theory. You don't have to know any game theory to enjoy it. Yeah.
So, given that this iterates out, does he have a theory as to maybe it doesn't work within the game that he constructed, but if everybody does tit for tat, does that create eventually mutual cooperation, or does it create apathy?
If everybody does tit for tat, then you get universal cooperation all the time, and everybody gets super payoffs. If everybody does tit for tat. you know, and you can see why, because everybody cooperates the first round, so nobody has a reason to defect in the second round, so everybody keeps cooperating. There are other, I mean, for those of you who find this intriguing, since Axelrod wrote the book, there's been the development of what's called experimental economics, in which these kinds of games get played in experimental situations, where you can do really interesting manipulations of the rules of the game to see how real people actually behave. This is a bit of a digression, which I think is worth doing, just it'll introduce you to some really interesting ideas, which you know sociologists won't necessarily always get exposed to. Here is my favorite example, because it's very clear and simple, and it's very rich in its implications. It's called a public goods game. So here's the setup. You have 10 people. You give them each $10. They can put into a common pot anywhere from nothing to $10. The experimenter will then double what's in the common pot and distribute it equally to everybody. So if everybody puts in $10, there's $100 in the common pot, it gets doubled to $200 divided by 10, everybody gets 20. Right? Now, you're an individual self-interested actor. This is why this is exactly like a prisoner's dilemma in its structure. You're a self-interested actor. It's anonymous, it's a one-shot game. And you ask, how much should I put in? What gives me the maximum payoff? Well, if I don't put in anything, and everybody else puts in 10, there's $90 in the pot, it gets doubled to 180. Everybody gets 18 back, but I kept my 10, so I have 28. What I do isn't going to affect what anybody else does because it's anonymous. Nobody sees anything. Everybody's making their own choice, right? If I put in 10, I get 20, so I'll make $8 less than if I keep my 10. So if I'm entirely rational, I understand all these payoffs, and I don't care about anybody else, and I don't have any moral principles that say what you ought to do, I'm just doing what's good for me, I won't put any money in. If everybody is like that, nobody puts any money in, and everybody ends up with $10 rather than 20. So you can see why this is exactly like the prisoner's dilemma. If the payoff possibilities, so to speak, are 28, 20 or 10. So what do people actually do? You can do this experiment, and you can do it in very poor countries. So this experiment has been done in Indonesia, rural Indonesia, where you also give people $10, which is a lot of money. You can, in some of these experiments, they give people $50 in poor countries. So the stakes are very big. What do people do? Well, it turns out that in most of these situations, if it's a one-shot game and it's anonymous, people will put into the pot somewhere between $5 and $8. They'll put in a significant part of the funds, but they'll hold back some. That is, they don't know how other people are going to behave. They are cautious, they hedge their bets, but they do contribute. It's not the case. Almost nobody puts in nothing. So people do put in some money. Now the participants in the game meet before the game begins and have coffee together, and then they play the game. It's still anonymous. The contributions go up. If people simply have met the other flesh and blood people that they're playing the game with. You can make this an iterated game. You can have many rounds. You can make it a game, for example, in which after the game, you've got your payout. You see what you earned. And you can and you see what everybody else earned, but you don't know who is who. You see the distribution. You can then give some of your money back to the experimenter, and the experimenter will take money away from a designated other person. You can punish people. You can see if they gave less to the common pot by how much they got back. And you can punish them with your own payoff. on some ratio. And what they find is that people are very willing to punish the free riders, even though they get nothing back from that. So it's a one-shot game. There's not future rounds of the game, so you're not punishing them in order to get more later. People have a motivation to punish free riders from this game. Yeah?
When they're having coffee, are they allowed to talk about strategies of the game or no?
I don't know. I think it's just meant to be a sociability situation. You can, if you play the game non-anonymously, people know what you're going to put in. And there are many rounds of the game. So after the first round, people know what's going to happen in the second round. They don't know what's going to happen, but they know something about the behavior of people. That also affects the way the game is played. If you add punishment into the game, if you have a multi-round game and you're allowed to punish after each round, it very quickly goes to universal cooperation. Everybody always just puts in $10. You know, a little bit of punishment goes a long way in increasing social cooperation. And one of the findings of this research is that there is spontaneously pretty high levels of cooperation. So it's not that the punishment has to overcome complete selfishness. The punishment overcomes ambivalence. And a little bit of punishment after the first round, and subsequently everybody knows the best payoff that they'll have is to... Well, they know two things. They know that there's a reliable cooperative payoff because the punishment mechanism punishes the free riders. They know that they're not going to be suckers by unilaterally cooperating. So it brings out, a little bit of punishment brings out actually good moral behavior. It's not just that people are acting in fear of the punishment, but they're acting in confidence that other people who might be acting in fear of punishment will act well. There was a hand. Yeah?
Yeah, I was just wondering if there had been any literature on comparing different societies, like different cultures.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. This is a completely fascinating body of literature. It's been, because these experiments are relatively cheap, you can do them all over the world, and they've been done in hundreds of places. Very interesting work on Eastern Europe and Russia. You know, the question is cynicism, how does that affect? And social capital trust and so on. There's a recent review essay or article by Sam Bowles in Science that reviews a lot of this literature that's worth reading. There are a few places in the world that behave very differently. And they're largely pre-market, small communities in Papua New Guinea, for example, where gift giving has a different, has the implication of dependence, right? So if you accept gifts from others, it implies that you're accepting their power over you. There's another game called a dictator game, which has the following character. I have $10. I can give you the $10. You then decide this is what it is. I have $10. You know I have $10. I give you some part of it. If you refuse the offer that I give you, neither of us get anything. If you accept the offer, then we keep whatever was the case. So the standard thing is, if I give you 50%, then everybody will accept it. If I have $10 and I give you $4, are you going to accept it or not? Well, if you turn it down, you're $4 poorer, but I'm $6 poorer. At some point, the unfairness of my division will trigger you refusing the offer. If I give you a penny and I keep $9.99, you're going to refuse it because it just seems so absurd, I'm being so ungenerous. So the question is, what's the threshold? At what point does it trigger you're being pissed off at the giver?
And aren't there significant gains that people are turning down just because they're insulted?
Yeah, yeah. So let's say it's $100. So I give you $25, I keep $75. if I mean, $25 is enough for most students to think twice about throwing it away. But a dollar might not be, right? So, and you can do this again in poor countries, so you can really, you can make the stakes a month's wages in this. Now the thing is, people are prepared to give up quite a lot to punish somebody who they think is acting badly. Now in the Papua New Guinea case, that's why I was bringing this up, the problem is gift-giving has a different meaning. So I've got the $10, I give you six and keep four for myself. Now in the U.S., if I keep four and give you six, nobody's going to turn it down. People might think I'm a little nuts. Why is this guy giving away the majority? But nobody will turn it down. They will in Papua New Guinea. Because accepting a gift has such a, at least in this one community, has such a salient meaning of obligation and subordination and status inferiority that they'd rather go without it. But that's, so that's a case where the game just has an utterly different meaning. It's not that in a situation that had that meaning, we would act differently. It's just that we don't have a situation with that meaning. Yeah?
I was going to ask, I'm probably way off on this, but this dictator game sounds a little bit like it could tell you something about whether people are willing to fight just on their own against, in a capitalist country against capitalist workers, because isn't that a similar idea, the conception of what the relationship is between capitalists and workers, where they give you only a fraction and they take for themselves, but then if you refuse it, isn't that saying you're putting forth some effort to change the circumstances for both of you to equal out the situation? So doesn't that sort of predict? I know, maybe it doesn't relate to solidarity, but
no, I think you're right. So what these games show very powerfully is that, first of all, shows a point that everybody knew already. People don't just act out of material self-interest. They have other things they care about, and one of the things they care about is fairness. So the fact that in a game situation, in this artificial constructed situation, people will refuse a financial gain to themselves because they feel it's unfair, that is, the other person who's giving it is acting unfairly, that they'll actually rather go without, knowing, of course, that they're punishing that person as a result, means that people are motivated by a sense of fairness, not just by what's separately in their own material interests. And I don't think there's a way of constructing this by which you say it is in the material interest of a person to refuse the $25. No, it's in their psychic interest. They're going to feel, one can make this simple kind of psychological argument. Yes, they'll feel better knowing the other person is suffering, not getting the $75, even though they don't have the $25. Well, that's the utility maximizing kind of view. Yes, they're maximizing their utility by refusing the $25. But that's only because they have a sense of moral obligation and to deal with fairness. So that is these are very powerful demonstrations of that. And it is absolutely crucial to understanding class struggle. Sure, I agree. If class struggles were just animated by pure material self-interest as such and not backed by a sense of fairness in some way or other, they wouldn't be as robust. Now, the iterated prisoner's dilemma shows you can get collective action, you can get cooperation, even without moral sentiment, but it doesn't show that that's the way you get robust collective action. All right, we've spent, because of digression, but I think you've now been exposed to the experimental economics literature that is incredibly interesting, has wonderful cross-national stuff, gender differences on these dictator games, and endlessly, this is relatively recent, and so there's endlessly interesting new things that are being done. There's a study that's been done around trying to get at corruption through this by doing these kinds of games with petty officials in different countries, and to see if the lower level bureaucrats in different countries play the game differently. I wish I know that that experiment is being done or has been done. I don't know the results to give you, you know, some tantalizing tidbits about it. But it's very good stuff. And even if it does come out of economics.
Well, there's a problem with that because the results would be known. Like, it's documenting. And instead of, because corruption is
no, these are games,
put so under the table, whereas this is public, and so it would reflect on the bureaucrat, wouldn't it?
Well, the particular person can remain anonymous, even if... okay. That's collective action with rational, selfish actors. I think what we should do is, let's take our break now, and then we'll return to the conditional altruism and assurance game, which is the guts of the problem of solidarity. So let's take our break now. Return at 10 after 11.
So I just sort of described what I wanted
that's,
to do.
That's good. I spent like 3 years because remember there was an extra one.
You actually
so it was the 3 consecutive days that weekend, so I just went to that
picture. But this one, I didn't actually read. No, I just
no, yeah.
I didn't know we were blessed.
Just when I can't. Just when I sleep 2 hours in a night and can't get my contacts
really?
In the morning. No, it was more than two, but it wasn't very many.
Okay.
Yeah, I do what it was.
That looks more professional.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, it looks that like a professor.
Oh, see, you're saying I look older.
So which of these? This is the one. So which was the one that you were because there's a bunch of more
professorial.
Oh, no, it's about the portal to the website. So, like, I was just going to talk about what would be the best strategy to go about, what would be the best progression for achieving journalism specifically in the United States? Like, what would be the first thing it would be in our interest to go for from where we are right now? It seems like, but I feel like I might be bringing in a lot of material from outside sources.
Yeah,
and even
I think that would be an example of the problem for scholars, but it would be not really engaging so much the material. I mean, it is true that in my interrogating inequality thesis, where I talk about I do invoke the idea of why, you know, gender aggression, what it means to eliminate it. But there isn't a whole lot of stuff in the
just because I thought it was interesting. The way that it actually turns out that Goldthorpe's analysis actually applies to the United States, even though it may be the case that, you know, it's sort of like the idea that, you know, maybe the planets don't rotate on epicycles, but it works the modules. So, I mean,
but that's a different, that's not so much, my discussion with Goldthorpe is not so much about conditions for gender,
Right, I know, which is why I actually wanted to, I thought it would be interesting to basically use those perspectives to to incorporate it into a totally new idea and see like how that would apply. That's a new idea.
Well, I mean, if you take, when you have to explain both those arguments, why the class position of women is derived from the head of the household.
Yeah,
I'd be curious to hear this. And how the male domination underwrites that observation.
And my point, I guess my point is, and I don't want to push this too much because, I mean, if you think it's a bad idea, it's probably a bad idea. But I mean, I sort of wanted to make the point that, you know, like Sweden, for example, I wanted to compare what's been done in other countries, and what's been done in other countries, sometimes it seems like, it makes sense if you're talking about a slow progression towards a social democracy, and you've already got sort of like a background for it, or like the ideas of genderlessness and stuff. But I think that like, Goldthorpe's analysis might actually make us think twice about the idea that the U.S. itself is well on the way towards a genderless society versus like the other countries in Europe. So you may want to consider.
Just so you know, in many respects, in certain respects, there's more gender inequality in Sweden than the U.S.
Lower it down.
And a few more irony, in the U.S., women are much more likely to be managers.
I guess, but then the question is, why is that?
And the reason is, you can argue, is because the Swedish social democracy is so generous on parental leaves, and the women take these very generous, well-supported leaves to take care of small children.
Well, this is what I was actually going to argue, is that I was going to say, well, I mean, I guess this, it sort of relates, but that's actually interesting to know. But what I was going to argue in my paper was that a good strategy would actually be, it would be in our interest to actually go for a specific thing to start out the progression towards a genderless society in the United States, where we don't have this sort of, we wouldn't be fighting for small business first, because it would take a long time to actually get people, raise people's consciousness about this whole thing. Since we're, I guess you said they're more or less, they have more inequality in Sweden. In certain respects.
In certain respects.
But I mean, I think that just, if I would, like Goldberg's analysis applies to the United States, since it makes so much sense, it does show that we are kind of backward to a degree if we're talking about Western industrialized countries. And I think that, I was just going to basically say that the first thing that we may want to consider fighting for, something that we could all like get behind, is the idea that men and women both have a specific a set amount of leave from work, and it's mandated by law, and both sexes have to take that leave. It's required. And one can't just opt to not take the leave. And it's paid. Because I wanted to explain in the paper that I think that is the case, that that's one of the most important things that actually leads to the gender equality inside over there to like economics and stuff. And it also that leads to more than just economic
inequality. I think it was a very persuasive No, it's more that it's tangential to the main body of this. It's better for these papers to really engage the material for us. So I don't, the ideas are fine. The paper I wrote in Perry Brinkhouse on gender equality, a strong gender egalitarianism, essentially arguments would be just like that. So I just think we could go through.